Okay, so this is the second in a new tradition of lectures on the top question in physics. Last week I discussed 10 top questions in fundamental physics. This week we're getting out of the nitty-gritty, and we're going to have a cast of hens led by Steve Durbin, who will outline the 10 top questions in metaphysics. And sometimes following this, we might have the 10 top questions in astrophysics. Next week there won't be any Black Bird Month, probably on the count, but the week after there'll be a talk by Rafael Busso on holography.
Okay.
I want you to know that I was drafted, and I'm doing this under duress. And actually, I want to start with a few comments for the youngsters in the audience, particularly in our field, why talking about a list of 10 fundamental questions is a bad idea. Just for the young and innocent here. Andy, would you like a chair?
Mm-hmm. Oh, maybe probably one.
That's why you're here, man. So what are the dangers of having a list of grand questions? For one, and these are suggestions that I got from various friends in the community when I gave a talk like this to the NSF recently, who thought it was a bad idea. So one is that, you know, a mix of the rather general and broad and the very specific is a strength of physics in general, and especially in condensed matter and materials physics. Advances have historically been made by sitting down and getting your hands dirty and doing detailed studies of rather specific problems before you. You don't sit down and say, I'm going to solve the following grand thing at the beginning. Remind us, Jim Langer has shown up. What a in particular, I remind the young people that Bob Laughlin started by thinking about free electrons and what they did and using a computer to look at their energy eigenvalues before he solved the fractional quantum Hall effect. Also, there's a fantastic diversity in our field of condensed matter and materials physics running over just an amazing range of things, which I'll try to touch on a little bit in a minute. And the predominance of a few central questions which could be detrimental. And in particular, progress can't be legislated from the top of our field, from the and in all streets. It's you young people who are going to make the progress. So you don't necessarily want to listen to some particular list of fundamental questions and work only on that. Also, unlike certain other fields, experimental surprises are a big strength of our field. An emergent phenomena which just arrive when you, mix together various nitty-gritty things can surprise us. And finally, I just want to remind the young people about Feynman's rule, which is you should work on what you find fun, not what this list tells you to do. Nevertheless, I'll make the list. So now for the people who are outside condensed matter physics, I will just take a minute and say something about, you know, what we do, or what are the fundamental kinds of questions that we have. And one paradigm for sort of what's fundamental in our field is that we're looking for new phases of matter. We're looking for phenomena which emerge at some low energy scale from, in our case, fairly known interactions, but they're still, even though we can write down the Schrödinger equation and we know all the terms in the Hamiltonian, we still get surprises. So, you know, a simple one would be if you took a whole bunch of copper atoms and separated them by a meter, you would have an insulator. If you put them together at zero temperature into a certain lattice, you would have a metal. You do the same thing with aluminum, which on astrophysical scales is basically an identical thing. Then it's an insulator when they're widely separated, but when you put them close together, there's a quantum phase transition, not into a metal, but into a superconductor. And the energy scales are pretty small, where before you can distinguish this, you have sort of Rydberg scales for individual atoms, electron volt scales for bands and bonds, and for the scale of the gap, it's five orders of magnitude down from the Rydberg. And it's because, so when you have such a huge range of scales to figure out what's going on, things can, very tiny couplings can be relevant as you scale down energy and pop up and surprise you. And in particular, you know, if we start with atoms and we go to bands, and we go to Fermi liquid, and then we have just some little bitty leftover one photon exchange interaction between the electrons, it's marginally relevant. It grows very, very slowly as you go down the scale, but it grows and grows and eventually makes superconductors. And actually, the fact that we have this intermediate place, the Fermi liquid, and then we can look at the stability of that with respect to this very tiny attraction. Actually, the fact that the scale is so small makes the problem easier. It turns out to give you a large length scale, which allows you to do mean field theory. And the problem's actually easy once Bardi and Cooper and people tell you what to look for and how to do it. The problem we're having in high-temperature superconductivity is that we may not have this sort of intermediate launching pad where we understand the moderately low-energy physics. And we may not have large length scales in order to... So we really don't know too much about what's going on, although that statement may be controversial in some quarters. Patrick will say something about that. Likewise, we can have this is quantum emergent phenomena. Same thing can happen classically. You can take little molecules that make up liquid crystals. You can add something to them so they develop a slight banana curvature, and suddenly they will form. They will spontaneously develop a chiral symmetry breaking. They'll make ferroelectric liquid crystals. Things will happen when you go from the scale of 10 angstroms to microns that the system organizes, and very tiny changes in the shape and details of the molecules can completely change what happens on the long length scales, which there's lots of technological uses of those things. This is sort of finite temperature statistical mechanics. You can have dye block copolymers where you have one kind of polymer and another kind of polymer attached together, and you can make a soup out of those things, and just depending on small changes you can get incredible diversity of phases. emerging. And all of this is just equilibrium physics. We also cover non-equilibrium physics, and I assume Jim Langer is going to say something about growth and aging and turbulence and granular materials and what happens when, some of those things. What happens when you have a dripping faucet and there's a, for instance, that's something that Sid Nagel is doing experiments on. The scaling of how the stream of water necks off and gets narrower and narrower, and then there's finally a drop, which and there's some singularity when it snaps off. It's just an amazing range of topics, from dripping faucets to high-temperature superconductivity, all of which are supposed to be covered by our field. So, okay. So I'll put down a quick list of questions and then pass the floor to my colleagues who are going to talk about a few minutes each on some specific questions.
Getting rid of dripping faucets is great.
Yes. Okay, so can we one thing that we have learned from high-temperature superconductivity is that oxide chemists have become emboldened by all of this and now making all kinds of incredibly complicated materials with so many atoms in the unit cell that it's starting to sound like biology. And can we rationally design them? Is there some way that we can make TC in a high-temperature superconductor at room temperature? I mean, what's the difference between 100 Kelvin and 300 Kelvin once you have gotten out of the low TC mindset? Are there any general principles that will allow us to think about these very complex materials? That's completely unclear. I mean, can theorists in particular contribute anything to this enterprise, or should we just let the oxide chemists mix stuff together and see what happens? So, complex materials and rational design. Another thing which is a bandwagon at the moment, if you will, is the physics of decoherence of mesoscopic quantum systems. The immediate point from the funding agencies being quantum computing. What's the fattest Schrodinger cat we can make? How large an object can we make that has more than one state and well-defined quantum coherence between those states, and can we entangle several of these objects to make qubits and do quantum computing? And there's some really nitty-gritty issues there about sort of quantum engineering of, you know, real qubits, 1 over F noise, and things that are very poorly understood about how these objects decohere. So there's both fundamental and applied things there. How do we reverse engineer biological objects? Cells and membranes and proteins. Are there any general principles in the spirit of the way we like to do things, or is everything just specifics? There's some mix of specifics we really do have to learn, force ourselves to learn a little biology, but there may be some general principles that have not yet been elucidated, which should be. Systems far from equilibrium. We have a general recipe or procedure. If we're dealing with equilibrium systems and there's something physics going on, symmetry breaking or something, we identify the symmetries, we write down some Landau-Ginzburg expression, quantum or classical, and we set certain coefficients to zero because we have certain known symmetries, and then we look for symmetry breaking, or, you know, we fit the coefficients to the experiment. There's a procedure. But for systems far from equilibrium, we're not even exactly sure what the questions are, whether there's a general analogous recipe to Landau-Ginzburg-Wilson. If such a thing exists, what is it? We don't know. Steve Kevelson's going to tell us about the glass transition in this kind of, well, this is plastic, but real glass. So I won't say much about that. He'll talk about it. But there's a different kind of thing, the spin glass, which has been studied for a long time and for which there are sort of two paradigms at the moment. A spin glass is a set of spins, typically classical, although now people are starting to think about quantum ones, that have interactions which are frustrated, that have differing signs, so that unlike in a ferromagnet where you line everybody up and all the bonds are happy, here, no matter how you orient the spins, there are always unhappy bonds, unsatisfied bonds. And a certain amount of progress has been made on this problem in infinite dimensions, but it's quite unclear what the relationship of that so-called replica symmetry breaking picture is to finite dimensions. There's a competing picture of a droplet. Roughly speaking, in some generalized configuration space of the spins, because of all these competing interactions, there are deep valleys in the phase space where the energy is very favorable, and high barriers between them, and below some temperature, it's becoming harder and harder to move between them. And in the thermodynamic limit, it's possible for these barriers to actually diverge. And there are questions people are still confused about: how many minima are there? There are an extensive number of deep minima, or just one plus its the ones that are related to it by global symmetries. That's not understood at this time. There's evidence that the infinite dimensional case, where people can kind of do a mean field theory, I'm told, I don't know too much about this, doesn't seem to look like the finite dimensional case. So I talked about emergent phenomena in the quantum case. So as a general question, what are the phases and or crossovers of electrons in two and three dimensions? One dimension, actually, just for technical reasons, is pretty well understood, and interacting electrons can be solved in some generality. For example, do metals exist? That's a question that the answer to that question is known if you have a disordered system but no interactions. Generically, the states, the electrons are localized. The states do not extend across the system. They're localized in some region, and the system in principle is an insulator, although in practice the localization is very weak, and the localization length might be so large that it still looks a bit like a metal. But there are some recent experiments that have suggested that in strongly interacting systems, maybe, even though you think that interactions would tend to make the localization stronger, there might be a quantum phase transition to a metallic state, although I'm not convinced yet that that's really true, but it's an interesting problem. that we have examples of phases of electrons in which the fractionalization occurs, in which you can have elementary objects that are not electrons. They're fractions of electrons or fractions of spin. And the quantum Hall effect, the quantum Hall effect is a good example. One might ask, can such things happen in two or higher dimensions without a magnetic field? And Patrick will say one sentence about that, I guess. Are there simple paradigms for non-Fermi liquids or singular Fermi liquid systems that don't obey, systems of electrons that don't obey the Landau Fermi liquid paradigm that we can either solve exactly or in some well-controlled way? That would be another problem. There's a general class of problems having to do with quench disorder. So this is random disorder that's frozen into the system, and you should ensemble average the logarithm of the partition function, not the partition function, over these degrees of freedom, because they're totally out of equilibrium. And you can write down lots of field theories, and in two dimensions, you can get these conformal field theories that are non-unitary. And people have had a lot of trouble trying to make progress on how to deal with this kind of quench disorder, and it gets worse when you add interactions.
What to do is do 6 and 8.
Well, yeah, you can, okay. A spin glass is a system that has quench disorder that frustrates the interactions. I'm thinking here of, you can have disordered electrons seeing disorder that doesn't produce any obvious frustration, and yet it makes localization or... Okay, so...
7 and 8.
Well, you can... I'm thinking here of interactions and here of disorder. Okay. I originally had 15 questions and sliced them down.
Maybe they're not all as logical.
Okay. Jim Lang is going to say something about the whole world of soft matter, non-linear dynamics, turbulence, all of these hard problems with H bar equals.
You're not.
Okay, he's not going to say that, but
there's a whole set of such problems
which I'm not an expert, so I'm not going to say much about, but about which we've been confused for a long time, and about which some progress is being made. But still pretty fundamental problems about which we're still pretty confused. Okay, and then finally, computation. You know, maybe this is experiment rather than theory, but
it would be extremely nice
to make progress in understanding how to deal with
the computing properties of
strong interacting quantum systems, and in particular fermions. And a nice thing which would be nice to solve is the sign problem, namely, how do you do a path integral for fermions in such a way that you're not taking computing the average sign of the propagator, which is exponentially, which is gives you, you know, the reason that the partition function for Fermi gas is so small is because the average sign is close to zero, and it's incredibly difficult to establish even basic things like, you know, does the Hubbard model contain superconductivity? A repulsive Hubbard model contains superconductivity. Can you go to low enough temperatures
And that in your simulations, and that's just incredibly difficult. And I mention this because this subject of computation, because progress has been made in the last decade. I mean, Steve White's density matrix renormalization group has basically solved all problems in one dimension. He's found a way to get exponential convergence of the to ground state energies and so forth, or in gap systems, and very, very fast convergence in non-gap systems. So he can calculate some energies, you know, on a workstation overnight to 10 digits in the ground state and so forth. Very hard to extend. So there's a real revolution. On the other hand, we haven't found a way to do that in higher dimensions. And this kind of ability to do numerical experiments on toy models is an extremely useful set of experiments, because we can ask questions that are more difficult for experiments on real systems to experimentalists to ask, and see if we're capturing the physics in our various models. And some progress has also been made with dynamical mean field theory, which I think Andy Millis will say something about, so I won't continue there. Oh boy. Okay, so I've run. I'm going to tell all the others to be brief, even though I haven't been. So the main question, the 11th question, is what experimental surprises will pop up which will render this list obsolete? And I think that's the biggest strength of our field, is that any list like this will be very rapidly become obsolete. Okay. So Patrick, Ron. So don't do what I did. Be more efficient. So Patrick's going to say some words about high temperature superconductivity.
That's really what's behind your first question, right?
Right.
You try to disguise it. I've actually spoken at length on this topic at the director's lunch a couple months ago, so I'm not going to spend too much of your time. But this is really a excuse for discussing a general class of problem which we call strong correlation physics. And so the in solid state physics, we deal with electrons, and electrons have the property that they hate each other. So this problem pops up all the time, and it's really a pervading theme in a lot of these questions. And I guess this high TC superconductivity really brought this issues against to the forefront of our attention in the last 10 years. And the issues there is really, the particular problem we're addressing here is what happens when you dope into a mod insulator. Doping of a mod insulator. And Steve has already alluded to what this problem is. The mod insulator is insulators that are insulating really because of this strong correlation that the electrons hate each other. And here in these cuprates, we have a realization of this particular example for the first time, I think, for some unknown reason. So a lot of us is very much concerned with that. You might ask, you know, why are so many people spending so much effort on this one material, right? I think the problems that we're addressing is really goes much deeper than that, because it goes to the heart of this hierarchy that Steve mentioned, the Fermi liquid behavior and the evolution of superconductivity. Up to now, superconductivity really comes out of a Fermi liquid state. And in these materials, we are very well established now that doesn't happen. And so it's really a new paradigm. And that's what got a lot of us excited. And the hope is that once we understand this new paradigm, that we can generalize this to other areas. There are certain certainly questions that we're asking now that we did not ask 15 years ago without before the superconductivity, such as the possibility of fractionalization, right, in two dimension other than the quantum Hall effect, whether the spin and charge is separated. Matthew would have been telling us about this today. But you know, these are new and exciting ideas. They may or may not apply to the cuprates, but even if they don't, they would undoubtedly show up in some other things in the next century. One thing that Matthew is very excited about are triangular lattices, right? Whether these, and there you have much better chance that these fractionalization actually happen. And the triangular lattice may be what's lurking behind these electron gas if you're nearing the crystal formation. Right? So I think those are all directions that we are thinking about. Now, so that's sort of a general picture that we are worrying about. I mean, I think of the high TC problem as very much analogous to the QCD that has been worrying particle physicists for a long time. And in both cases, we know the basic Hamiltonian. We know what's behind it. I think a lot of us agree that the Hubbard model is a very good starting point for describing these strong correlations. So I think we can write down Hamiltonian, everybody. Most people would agree. And I also happen to believe that many of us think there's a qualitative understanding of the basic physics. I mean, QCD is confinement and all that. People have an asymptotic freedom. People have pretty good qualitative understanding. And I think we actually do. We understand that what drives us are antiferromagnetism, that the energy scale is set by exchange energy of the spin. And what drives this thing is the competition between antiferromagnetism and the kinetic energy of the holes that the hole wants to move around. I think a lot of us really believe that that's true, and I think that we're coming to a consensus on that. What we need is some more quantitative theory, and here we also share the same problem with QCD. It's a strong coupling problem. There's no expansion parameter, right? And now we can create artificial expansion parameter like large n, large dimension, large spin, and hope that gets to where you want to do, but ultimately is all based on some hope. But I think here we have an advantage to QCD because in solid state physics we have experiments and we really can work very closely with experimentalists. And I think this problem is not going to be solved by some clever young person writing down some wave function, right? You know, a crazy young person writing down some wave function and then say that this is it. I don't think the nature of this problem is not it is, it's far too complex and rich. It's probably going to take a lot of digging and a lot of back and forth between theory and experiments. And you know, I think to make real progress, as theorists, we have to make really concrete, precise predictions. And experimentalists are very willing to go and prove us wrong. And in this process, we might get to where we want to be. And I think we are starting this workshop. We're starting very much on that direction. And as to whether we can make quantitative prediction. I mean, that's where the sign problem is, right? If someone can lick the sign problem, then someone can tell us what TC is as a function of the parameters. But in some sense, the high TC problem is an easier problem than conventional superconductivity because the number of parameters are few, right? And it's relatively high energy physics. So there should be somewhere out there a formula that says TC as a function of exchange coupling, you know, hopping integral and the doping concentration. Right? There's something out there. And unlike the phonon problem, there is no upper bound on TC. For a long time, people discussed, for a BCS mechanism, that there should be upper limit for TC above 40 Kelvin. And if you now abandon that and say we have electronic mechanism, there's no fundamental limitation. And everything we talk about is scalable. Right? If you can make a material with larger exchange, I think most of us believe that TC would go up. Now, how this is going to work is, can we really, really design things? And I think there, theoretical physicists has an atrocious track record, so I don't think we can claim any prospect that we can teach material scientists how to make new material and what to design. I think we don't understand enough about you know, what makes things stable. And there's so much, the phase space out there is so large. I think it's kind of hopeless for us. But maybe I'll be proven wrong again. But anyway, so I think, yeah, I should stop.
Okay, good. Andy, do you want to go next? This is Andy Millis.
Oh, I see. This is musical chairs, is it? All right. Okay. So, right. All these things, as everybody else has said, make one a little bit uncomfortable. But my question, slightly ill-posed, is basically doing quantitative calculations of things which are not ground state energies, especially in metallic systems. On the same level of accuracy as we have for ground state energies. For example, what is TC of what is the transition temperature of strontium, ruthenium, oxygen, O3? What is the superfluid stiffness of all right.
Isn't that zero?
What?
O3. No, O3 is zero. That's not superfluid.
Yeah. Well, it's a ferromagnet. It still has a TC.
Oh, TC.
Curing. this is an important goal of condensed matter physics. It's sort of the other side of the coin from the... and I'm going to have to write it small because I don't want to erase Steve's list of new phases and qualitative properties. And it's not only important, because after all, we want to know things about solids. It involves, I would say, in most of the interesting materials, a new concept or concepts which we don't really have yet. To be specific, what we can do in condensed matter physics for calculating is, for all but perhaps the most strongly correlated systems, we know how to do reasonably good jobs on ground state energies. From density functional theory, various kinds of quantum Monte Carlo calculations, and so on. We also know how to do what amounts to free field or free particle theory plus perturbation. And when you think about it, most diagrammatic calculations, which are there in the literature, amount to saying that basically you know what the particles are, and you know that they interact weakly enough that it's still sensible to talk about them as particles. So these are the two things, broadly speaking, that we can do well. And it doesn't get you where you need to be here. And so I would submit that the reason it doesn't get you to this is that there is a concept or concepts that we're missing. Now, one possible example of such a concept is this business, which has really been pushed forward by my colleague Kotliar at Rutgers. And Because I should stop very soon, I'm not going to explain it to you in detail, except to say that it's a calculational prescription, which works, is justifiable in some theoretical limits, and in which the basic object, the basic moving part, is not a particle, like here, but a spectral function, more or less a local function of frequency, something like this, right? And okay, so this is one thing. There are probably others, and this is the problem. And I'll stop here.
Andy, could you comment on why calculating, say, the free energy or particular TC isn't just like adding one more dimension and then saying you're doing something with a coupling constant?
Yes. And that's, in fact, thank you. I should have said here, but I would like to stress dynamic properties. But to come back to TC, which I concede is a static property, particularly in metallic systems, it's not one dimension, it's more than one dimension. The characteristic of metals is that the excitations are overdamped because there's a Fermi surface. So in the language of critical phenomena, dynamical exponents are bigger than one. Right? So you don't have propagation in the time direction, you have decay. So it's not just like another. So only in a very formal sense is it like another dimension. Right? You have, if you like, mod omega, and you have q squared. That's what's different.
It's different than imaginary time?
Yeah, because it's mod omega. It's non-analytic in one direction and analytic in the other. Of course, you can subsume it into the same formula, but this has content. This is different from a theory of propagating bosons. Right. The extra dimension doesn't enter on exactly the same footing as the dimensions you had before. Oh, because it's damping again. Because basically you make an excitation and what it does is it decays into particle hole pairs. So it's mod omega in imaginary time, actually, and I omega in real time.
The analytic continuation
of mod omega.
The branch gap.
Yeah.
It can be worse than that. It can be mod omega for one kind of excitation.
I'm sorry, Phil.
It's the propagating and decaying excitations. I believe that's what happens in ITC.
I'm sorry, I just couldn't hear what you're saying.
Saying you can have both propagating and decaying excitations at the same time in the same material.
Yeah.
And I think that's what happens in ITC. That's why it's
Yeah. So for the record, what you said was that there are many problems where you can have both two kinds of excitation, some of which are propagating and some of which are decaying in the same material, and that's what makes high TC hard. And
Yeah, so I hope it's okay. I'd like to show some transparencies because I think that, unlike the other topics here, I think many people here may not really know. People repeat that this is an important problem, indeed it is, but that I'm not sure that everybody here knows what the basic phenomenon is. So I hope you don't mind. So basically, the problem of the glass transition is what happens as you take certain liquids and supercool them below their crystallization temperature, and the viscosity grows to be enormous. And when the viscosity gets to be something like 10 to the 13th poise, relaxation times get to be longer than a graduate student lifetime, and so the system falls out of equilibrium. And below that, it's a glass, but above it, presumably the system is in equilibrium, or at least local equilibrium. Now, so this is the basic thing, this is the viscosity of ortho-terphenyl, and what you see here is this is log base 10, and this is 10 to the minus 2 poise, and this is 10 to the 13th poise. So over a very small range of temperatures, the viscosity rises by 15 orders of magnitude. Mostly one is interested in so-called fragile liquids. This is an example of a fragile liquid where the rise of this viscosity, as you can see, is super Arrhenius. There are so-called strong liquids in which there's just some big activation energy. And so you can sort of understand why the viscosity gets so big. There, things are bonded together and they have to activate over some barrier, and at some point the temperature is too low to do that. Another way of plotting the data to make this clear is to plot as if you were plotting a temperature-dependent activation energy. That puts in a little bit of a prejudice in that you have to extract the high temperature slope to know what this eta infinity is. But when you do that, I could take T times the log of the viscosity over eta infinity as a function of temperature. And what you see is that it's a constant above the melting temperature. And then it rises. So the activation energy gets bigger as you go below some temperature that's somewhat below the melting temperature. Here's some actual data. This is the log of either the viscosity or some relaxation time versus, well, it's inverted. This is versus 1 over temperature. And here's this plot of activation energy. And so you see that the activation energy can rise here in O-terphenyl by a factor of 3 or 4. So that's really spectacular slowing down. So there are a few other things that occur in super-cooled liquids. One is that there's a certain pattern to relaxation. You calculate some relaxation of some quantity, and it has a drop on molecular time scales. And then it has a long plateau region where it drops a little. And then there's a long time at which it exhibits typically stretched exponential behavior. Here beta will be somewhat less than 1. It's conventional to talk about alpha relaxation times, which are somehow these long times that control the dynamics out here, and to identify something called beta relaxation, which occurs at intermediate times. There isn't a lot of decay that occurs in intermediate times, and as a fairly ignorant person, I'm not positive that that's a very well-defined concept. At any rate, most of the things that I've talked about and will talk about deal with the alpha relaxation, and just where that ends is a little bit of a matter of controversy. Let me show you again some data. This is of the Fourier transform of, well, in this case, the dielectric trick susceptibility. And that looks more or less the same for all materials and all temperatures in this supercooled regime. It's very non-exponential. That is to say, Fourier transform is very non-Debye. As you can see, there is both very substantial tails at the high frequency wing, and there's some interesting structure at the low frequency wing as well. And one of the few new things that's really been understood since Phil's article pointing out how important this is in ill condensed matter is this remarkable thing that Sid Nagel realized, that basically all the data over this whole range of temperatures and whole range of materials, the dynamic data, could be collapsed onto a single scaling function using the peak frequency and the full width at half maximum and a normalization factor to collapse the data. And, you know, it doesn't work perfectly, but it works pretty darn well. Okay, so now all of that's dynamics. The thing that's sort of surprising is that there's very little evidence of anything interesting thermodynamic going on while all of this is going on. The structure factor, the density-density correlation function matter measured in scattering experiments, basically looks the same in the liquid, in the supercooled liquid, in the glass, for that matter, other than a bit of thermal expansion. The only thing that really shows any dramatic temperature dependence is the entropy. And it's customary to measure the entropy relative to the entropy of the crystal. And then what one sees is as you cool the system down, okay, you fall out of equilibrium here at this glass transition temperature. But were you to extrapolate it, you would find that it would extrapolate to zero at some temperature a little bit below the glass transition temperature, which is called the Kaussmann temperature. And at least in many systems, if I took the viscosity here and fit it to a form that diverged at some temperature below the glass transition temperature, then you would notice that these two temperatures were close to each other, suggesting that that maybe is the temperature that you might organize things about. Okay, and again, here's some pictures of data on that. Okay, there's one more interesting thing, I believe, that's somewhat new in terms of experimental input as to what's going on here. One can ask the question about whether this this dramatic slowing down of the system is due to somehow either large barriers or to a lack of free volume, that things are just jammed together so much that they can't move. And the reason that's a little hard to say is that most of the experiments, all the experiments I've showed you so far, are done at fixed pressure. So as you change the temperature and the viscosity gets slow, at the same time the density is changing, and so you don't really know whether you're seeing an effect of changing density or changing temperature. But the obvious way to correct for that is to ask, what does the viscosity do as a function of density at fixed temperature, and what does it do as a function of temperature at fixed density? And that was done recently. Here's the viscosity at fixed pressure as a function of temperature. As a function of density in this case. So using the thermal expansion, that's the this super Arrhenius behavior of the viscosity plotted as a function of density. And these curves here are curves at fixed temperature as a function of density. So you can see that there really isn't much in the way of slowing down of the system if you hold the temperature fixed and vary the density. On the other hand, if you hold the density fixed and vary the temperature, so here's again the constant pressure curve. And as you can see, the constant density curves look more or less like the constant pressure curves. So I think it's clear here that what's going on is an increase in the size of barriers, not something having to do with a lack of free volume. Steve, should I stop?
Yeah.
Okay.
Anything you want.
Okay, I'm going to change the topic almost entirely, because there's a huge world of stuff in soft matter, including polymers, liquid crystals, things of that sort. Nonlinear phenomena, turbulence. We've had a whole program here recently on turbulence, and that is still not a really tightly pinned down subject, and it's obviously of enormous theoretical interest. But I would like to change pace altogether and bring in some, sort of out of left field, some stuff that has been fascinating me for the last several years. And the general topic is deformation and failure of solids. And I'd like to put, and just to generalize it a little bit, solid-like materials. And it strikes me that this is an area that, number one, is of immense practical importance, especially if you think about not only engineering, but I put in solid-like there because I'm thinking ahead to the fact that we're going to have to be dealing more and more with biological materials. And biological materials are often not exactly solid, but they support shear stresses. And they're complex. And biological processes, like deformation and failure and fracture and things like that, are almost all strongly non-equilibrium problems. So that they're in a class of problems that we're not very accustomed to dealing with. But I'd like to make a point which I'm developing courage to make more and more publicly and more strongly over the last year or so, is that when we talk about this subject, and in particular I'll talk about fracture, or just bending, deformation of solids, this has been a problem that has been in the hands of engineers and applied mathematicians for at least half a century. And in my opinion, there has been very, very little really fundamental progress made. The theories of plasticity, for example, in solids are almost entirely couched in terms of the problems of the theory of dislocations moving in single crystals, pure crystalline materials, whereas we know that all of the same phenomena occur in glasses, in amorphous glassy metals, in plastics, and for that matter in various kinds of complex biological materials where you can't talk about dislocation theory at all. Now, I wanted, the way I can introduce this, and at least in a few minutes, perhaps convince you that there's some really very deep questions that are sitting here, is just to show you some of the unsolved problems. The easiest one to talk about is the fact that that brittle fracture is always, or almost always, unstable. In other words, if I take a piece of material and pull it like this and get a crack going here, it may be smooth for a little while, but it always starts wiggling around. If as soon as it goes fast enough, it sends side branches off. We now know, only actually for the last decade, because of some very neat experiments at Austin by Harry Swinney and his group, we now know that this is an intrinsic property of solids, in non-crystalline, crystalline materials. You can cleave certain things if you do it very carefully, but almost always when you break something, and this is, we all know that. If I break glass, the surface is rough. We don't know, however, what the nature of that instability is. It's as if we had gone back to the 1930s when G.I. Taylor showed us these nice instabilities in fluid flow, or the 1950s when Mullins and Sakirka and company showed us what the basic instabilities were in solidification pattern and snowflakes and things like that that I've talked to so many of you about in the past. We still don't have the equivalent understanding of what produces that kind of an instability in fracture. I find that quite remarkable. Actually, I have some ideas now this week, but I don't know whether they'll be my ideas next week about what the right answer to that is. Now, let me give you a related example. And all materials have some sort of plastic yielding. What that means is that if I I take a material, the least good thing to deal with on this is this piece of wood, but if we had a metal pointer here, I could do it. But if I take it and I put a stress on it, if I put a large enough stress, it will bend, and so that, in fact, when I relieve the stress, it will stay bent. Everybody knows that. And now, the standard theories of fracture all say that the tip of the crack is a sharp point, and therefore is concentrating stress like a lightning. There's a lightning rod effect. So there's some region around here in which those stresses, if you just calculated them like that, would have to be bigger than this plastic yielding stress. And therefore, the big question that has been engaging the professionals in this field for decades now is, well, how do you ever get breaking stresses through the tip of that crack? And you know, most theories, most ideas about how you explain that have to do with dislocations piling up and stuff like that. But the same things happen, obviously, in non-crystalline materials. Well, there's an even bigger puzzle having to do with plasticity, and that is that if I take a very simple material, even the materials that some of us, in particular Mike Falk, a student who finished here a year or so ago, simulate on a computer, and if I, in principle, bend it like this, this material will remember the direction in which it's bent. And we all actually know that, because if you bend it like this, what you know is you apply the same force in the same direction, and it'll think it's sort of just going back and forth elastically. Whereas if I apply the same force in the opposite direction, it bends back. That's a trivial thing until you think about it, because then the question is, what is it that the molecules, it doesn't have to be complicated molecules to do that. The simplest sort of pot metal does it. What is it inside there? How could I look inside that material and just look at the configurations of the molecules in the region that was bent, and how are they remembering which way they had bent? I think we have some ideas about that now, it's still quite a remarkable property to me. Obviously, highly in the non-equilibrium, far from equilibrium, very far from equilibrium, a class of behaviors of materials. But until we understand answers to questions like those, I don't think we're going to be able to do either predictive calculations of new complex materials that they're going to make sure that the airplane wing stays on my airplane, or extend our ideas to trying to understand the properties of biological materials, which I think we all agree is this vast new world that is opening up before us. So that's my nomination for a big area of fundamental interest for the at least the next decades.
Well, are there any questions for the presenters? And also, since this was rather a collective exercise, if there's anyone in the audience who thinks that a important question in the field has been left out, this is the time to put it in.
It's what we call that kind of question. I've raised the question of, I've raised it in print, perhaps rather foolhardily, that the concept of a wave function, I'm speaking about non-relativistic quantum mechanics, which we learn by looking at the Schrodinger equation and doing a few examples, preferably example soluble ones, or examples that involve rather few particles, that concept intrinsically loses its meaning when you get to something like on the order of 1,000 particles. And that has raises some practical questions, but also raises some questions in epistemology. And this is not the time to expound it. I just want to add it to the things on the board.
Well, David asked me to repeat the question for the record. So I guess Walter is asking, are wave functions useful objects when you have lots and lots of particles? So
not useful, but meaningful.
Meaningful, okay. So are you thinking that, I mean, we should just be thinking about density matrices or what?
It's not that simple.
But Walter, there are, we do have successful and experimentally successful theories with an infinite number of degrees of freedom.
Yes.
An infinite number of degrees of freedom where we haven't modified quantum mechanics.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you convinced me that this is not that as well as anybody. and that's not in the least contrary to what I said. What I was saying was that the meaning of a Schrodinger wave function intrinsically loses its meaning. Not that there are not well-defined properties of arbitrary large systems, well defined as could be characterized.
Nominations.
Yeah, maybe a bit of a general thing. You said that condensed matter, what we have as principal thing that we learn is the whole idea about emergence of new phenomena, new states of matter. So assume that this phenomenon of emergence is not something that stops with condensed matter in complex systems and biological systems. Maybe it's like that's a question of what do we learn from condensed matter? What kind of general principles can we learn that can be generalized outside of the particular physics models that we can solve, whether there are some general properties, general methods, principles like broken ergodicity or whatever that is beyond broken symmetry that can be generalized to understand in a qualitative way things that are not particular electron systems.
Yeah, I think that's a very good question, and right now I'm a little pessimistic that we, how generalizable our general principles really are. It's not completely clear.
Well,
I don't particularly want to raise a new question, but to add a question to Steve's question last. We don't understand the low temperature behavior of glass either, and that is quite a mystery. And also, it's a very general phenomenon in various kinds of amorphous and even crystalline systems that there are low temperature excitations, which we don't seem to ever we postulated them, somebody else here and myself, quite a number of years ago, but we didn't know what we were talking about, and we knew we didn't know what we were talking about, and I would argue that we still don't know what we were talking about.
I regret not having handed you the microphone. Now we have an opposing view, or?
No. What Phil has raised is in fact in line with what Steve talked about, because there is growing evidence that the number of low-lying states measured by entropy at low temperatures seems to be proportional to the difference between the glass temperature and the cosmic temperature.
I see.
Okay, well, let's thank everyone.